Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 26th of June. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled in Shelby County versus Holder that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which outlines how the government is to determine which states, counties, towns, and other jurisdictions have to have their voting laws pre-cleared by the Justice Department, was declared unconstitutional. Section 4 had provided a formula that determined states based on past discrimination. There were 16 states, mostly but not exclusively in the South. Actually, there were some areas of New York, which our guest this hour, or most of the hour, is familiar with and will talk about. And they were areas that have had a documented history of discriminatory voting dating back to Jim Crow. Jamie Floyd joining us for a good portion of this hour, legal and political analyst for many outlets. She has worked for Court TV, ABC News, CBS News, and has appeared on virtually every other major news network. She frequently guest hosts on WNYC Radio in New York City. We'll be welcoming phone calls, your thoughts about this ruling that took place yesterday, whether or not you think Congress has the political will to re-examine the map, to refashion the map, or if that's not going to happen. And there are some states that have moved ahead with things like photo ID. And they did it hours after the ruling yesterday by the Supreme Court, which they may not have been able to do because they were in one of those areas that had had long time discrimination. Our phone number for you to join this conversation, I hope you will, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are going to be talking about the Defense of Marriage Act, which the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional, and also Proposition 8. And they ruled that proponents did not have legal standing to appeal, so we'll look at those rulings tomorrow. We'll give us time to read more about them during the course of today. Tomorrow at 9, we will look at those rulings, which are very important. But we'd like to hear your thoughts about yesterday's ruling as well. Jamie Floyd, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I was interested in something that you were talking about yesterday, which I was not aware of. These states that had to seek approval were mostly southern states, but there were also some parts of New York that had to seek approval. I was not aware of that.
That's right. 9 states in the South, but parts of 7 states elsewhere, including right here where I'm sitting in the middle of New York City, Manhattan.
Ah.
You would never think it, right?
No.
And the Bronx and parts of Brooklyn. So it is not just the South, though of course we think of the Deep South when we think of the Civil Rights Movement and the Voting Rights Act, but when Congress initially enacted these provisions that are at issue that we're talking about today, the formula was applied to 7 states, portions of 7 states that are not in the Deep South. So that's a little bit of trivia for our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that Congress has it within itself right now to come up with a new formula if some of them would agree the formula is out of date, but discrimination still exists? We need a new formula?
Well, I think we do need, now that the Supreme Court has invalidated the current formula, a new formula. But I don't think Congress has it within its political will, if you would accept that phraseology.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have partisan bickering and battling over voting rights as much as over any other issue. And part of the reason the formula has not been changed since 1976, that is the last time the formula was changed, as noted in the opinion, is because Congress can never come to any agreement about a new formula. So I'm not hopeful that they can come up with a whole new iteration of this law, even though I think most folks, even conservatives, would agree that somewhere, sometimes, there is a need for oversight by state or federal officials. No one wants to deem their jurisdiction, their state, their local authorities as bad actors in terms of voting rights.
Shortly after the decision was announced yesterday, Texas decided to go ahead and it would become law, they said, immediately with their photo ID. A lot of states, mostly conservative states, have had laws that lower courts are looking at right now that would establish photo IDs or get rid of same-day registration or early voting. You know the whole list here. Will the Supreme Court be looking at those particular pieces of legislation that may be deemed, as some opponents would say, discriminatory?
Well, I think that is correct. I think the Justice Department could bring new lawsuits as to each of these new, I don't want to say activities, but these new approaches to voting, voter ID, all of these controversial in some ways of thinking approaches to voting. In the dissent, of course, Justice Ginsburg talked about the second wave of voter concern in the modern era. You know, that we may have been talking in 1965 about one way of discriminating in voting, but now we have new and modern ways. Discriminatory tactics, racial gerrymandering, as you mentioned, voter ID. And these things perhaps will be pursued all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But that's a long arc. Mm-hmm. And of course, there is the parallel track of lobbying Congress. You know, I don't want to be too cynical when I say they can't come up with a new formula. So there is the parallel track of lobbying Congress to try to come up with a new formula. And so there are, we shouldn't be too terribly hopeful or cynical. And there are those who think this was the right decision. We should try to be somewhat objective in our analysis, that times have changed, that there are more black people who vote, African-Americans, people of color, immigrants who vote, and more people of color in office. So certainly times have changed. The question is whether or not they have changed enough to have warranted this decision at this time.
Well, what do you think happened? Because I was looking at some of the reaction from former President Bush with the reauthorization of this act in 2006 and how proud he was to sign it, and people on the dais who were Republicans, everybody signed that. Everybody said it was a really great thing. That wasn't very many years ago. What happened?
No.
What's happened?
Well, it's quite fascinating. I mean, I covered that at the time. I went down to Selma with Congressman John Lewis, of course, who marched on Selma in 65 and has been in Congress since the 1980s and marches on Selma every single year to remind us that, as he sees it, the Voting Rights Act is still a valid and necessary piece of legislation. And yes, you are correct that President Bush signed the reauthorization in 2006. But there are those, and a very slim majority in the court, feel that this one provision, Section 4, a formula that is used to identify the state and local governments that have to comply with this preclearance. So we're talking again about those 16 jurisdictions who want to make a change in their voting laws. The real question, and this goes back to our fundamental question as a nation, do states have to seek permission from the federal government when they make a change to their laws if there's some history of discrimination in voting rights and voting access and voting equality? Or can they make the change, and then if someone has a complaint, the burden is now on the complainant to show discrimination?
And
that is the change that happened yesterday. Now we, the voter, have the burden to show to the court discrimination in these 16 jurisdictions, whereas yesterday and since 1965, the burden was on these 16 jurisdictions to show that their voting practices were not discriminatory.
You mentioned,
and so to answer your question, what has changed, the court says, so much has changed that they no longer have that burden.
Mm-hmm. And in order to challenge something, it could, as you said earlier, take a long, long time for that to happen.
Yes. And what is really fascinating here, it really is about your point of view in this country, who you are as an American. Justice Roberts wrote, quote, "Today the country is no longer divided along those lines." And, of course, he means racial lines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some of us agree with that. and some of us don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what's changed. The majority of the court feels the country is no longer divided along those lines, and Justice Ginsburg and the minority of the court feel that the country is still divided along those lines, and our Congress has a point of view on that, too, and we'll have to see how strongly they feel.
Right.
Do they feel strongly enough to do something about it? But, you know, so much in our country is affected, including legislative policy, by our point of view, where we sit in the society, and we'll see what happens going forward. But that is what has changed. The majority of the court does not see this as, not that they don't see the Voting Rights Act as necessary legislation, but this formulaic requirement. You still, the Section 5, which allows for, Section 5, there are two sections, 4 and 5, that were at issue.
Mm-hmm.
It is still, you still have preclearance, is still constitutional. It's the formula about which states must seek reclearance that is struck, that has been struck down. Does that
right.
make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. It makes complete
okay.
sense. We were talking
those
about
states, they felt they were being discriminated against.
Right. Yeah. I always, you were talking about Congressman Lewis, and I always pay careful attention to what he has to say, because he almost died over this whole issue. And
yes.
He's a remarkable human being. He was saying last night, you know, go with him. Take a walk with him to Selma County. Take a walk with him to Mississippi. Take a walk with him to Texas. Take a walk with him to parts of the South. And it was his very firm belief that discrimination in this whole area still exists, and it is still fairly widespread. Was that case not presented very fully before the Supreme Court? Was he not speaking the truth here? How could that be missing?
I think the case was presented quite fully, and I agree with you entirely about John Lewis, and you are correct. He very nearly died in that first, there were three marches on Selma, and in the first march, he very nearly died. And he tweeted yesterday, "Today the Supreme Court stuck a dagger into the heart of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so for John Lewis, this is a very sad day indeed, and the traditional civil rights community, a very sad day indeed. But I do think the case was well presented for retention of Sections 4 and 5. But at the same time, Justice Roberts included in his opinion, the majority opinion, a chart. Unusual, really, a chart in the opinion with facts and figures and statistics that he claims support the majority opinion that times have changed. So, again, it is about point of view in this case, about a feeling that at least with regard to which states fall under the preclearance requirement, perhaps we need a new formula. And I did a little bit of reporting on this today. There are those who say that perhaps the court is right, that perhaps Congress is at fault here, that they've been so disorganized or so there's so much bipartisan bickering since the 1970s, they should have gotten it together and come up with a new formula. And many of these same jurisdictions would have fallen under any formula.
Mm-hmm.
But the court perhaps is right to wag its finger at Congress. There was an earlier case, Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District, in which the court warned Congress to get a new formula together not that long ago.
Yeah.
And the court is now essentially saying, we warned you, you didn't get the new formula together, this is a bigger slap on the wrist.
Hmm.
We're slapping you down.
But now, Jamie, as you well know, this has become such a political issue that it's mostly in Republican states in this country where photo ID, where same-day registration,
yeah.
where early voting is becoming something that many Republicans want to do away with, and Democrats want those. So you've got such a political
yeah.
football here, it's hard to believe yeah. Congress is going to do a darn thing.
Well, and very often, I don't think it's too terribly cynical to say, very often voting measures are manipulated to ensure a particular outcome. And the people left with the short end of the stick are poor people, people of color, the elderly. And that is the great concern of civil libertarians, including the greatest civil liberties group of all, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, now known as LDF. So we're still fighting the same battle we've always fought. And even though I've presented the objective case for the majority, I think Justice Ginsburg really has it right that this is the one amendment, the 15th Amendment, that is not really supposed to rest in the purview of the court. Many of the great amendments ultimately come to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they come down with the great decisions that have given us real power in the constitutional rights that we all enjoy. Even though they came through the civil rights movement, we all enjoy those rights, mm-hmm. not just African Americans, but all of us. But this right to vote is written very clearly to be something that Congress enforces. And she's correct about that, and she writes about that very, very powerfully in her dissent. And I think I do believe she's correct. I don't seek to second guess either of the great thinkers on the court. But obviously, a dissent by Justice Ginsburg, where she says the 15th Amendment is different from the other post-Civil War amendments. Mm. The enforcement of the right to vote is vested in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And the Voting Rights Amendment is the one that really gave meaning on the ground to the issues that we fought, not just the civil rights movement over, but the Civil War.
Civil War.
And some see this today as the end of the civil rights movement.
Well, let's ask our audience. We don't have a whole long time with Jamie, but is this the end of the civil rights movement? That's really the question. Which we think about as a result of yesterday's Supreme Court ruling in Shelby County versus Holder that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, it outlaws, as you've heard her describe, how the government is to determine which states, counties, towns, and other jurisdictions have to have their voting laws pre-cleared by the Justice Department. It was declared unconstitutional. What do you think of this? Was it time for this to happen? It's a whole different country, or does it really indicate the end of the civil rights movement in the United States? I'm interested in your response. Please call us. We want to hear from you. You can also send an email if you would like. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave messages there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is Jamie Floyd, legal and political analyst for many outlets. She's worked for Court TV, ABC News, CBS News, a lot of public radio stations. She frequently is a guest host on WNYC Radio in New York City. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's get through as many phone calls as we can. Tomorrow, we, of course, will be looking at today's big Supreme Court decisions, saying DOMA is unconstitutional, and also looking at a favorable ruling for gay marriage in California with Proposition 8. Tomorrow, Marsha Coyle, chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal, will be with us, and Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA, to talk about those decisions during the 9 o'clock hour of the show. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Is the number. Email is talk@wpr.org. Let's start with Ruth. Hi, Ruth. You're on the air. Ruth, go ahead. Turn the radio down, please.
Oh, okay. I didn't know I was on so quick.
Yeah, you are.
Yes. Wow. Is that super? Okay. Just been listening, and I'm very concerned about this decision this morning by the Supreme Court. I had been following this and was wondering what would happen. I feel we're going to run into trouble here, just like when the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed in the early 90s at the time of the Clinton administration, and we had all of this trouble with the banking sector in 2008. And now it's, you know, repairs have to happen, but if that wouldn't have been tampered with, we wouldn't have had this problem.
Could we talk about yesterday's vote? What are your concerns about yesterday's Supreme Court decision?
Well, I feel that we're, as John Lewis said, this was such a hard won effort in the 60s. And, you know, when this was set up, it was, I think that we're not going to have action in the Congress as we need it because of the polarization.
Thank you, Ruth, very much for the call. Jamie, would you like to respond?
Well, I think that's an excellent point. The court is not really supposed to think of long-term ramifications from its decisions. They're only supposed to think of immediate constitutionality. But she's right. The court asked Congress to determine a new formula. Without Section 4, there really is no Section 5. And given Congress's inability to get anything done, I think we essentially have a Voting Rights Act with no heart.
Dan is next in Gordon. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I'm puzzled by something. Since this decision came down, I keep hearing that the justification for it is the facts have changed. That is, things are different from the 60s.
Yeah.
But it's my understanding that it's the Congress that makes determinations. That's a legislative decision. It makes determinations what the facts are that need to be fixed, and they pass laws. That the Supreme Court decides what the law is. So it seems to me, and I'm not an expert on this, it seems to me that the Supreme Court is making a legislative decision here, and I'm wondering if your guest could respond to that.
That's exactly the argument that Justice Ginsburg made in her brilliant dissent. And you can read her dissent at a wonderful website called SCOTUS Blog. You can also go to the U.S. Supreme Court website, but that's exactly what she said. And one of the things she points out is that in the reauthorization process in 2005 and 2006, the Congress went through weeks and weeks of legislative hearings about these very sections that were before the court and determined that they were still relevant and adequate for these times. And so why then, she says, should the Supreme Court, a body that is supposed to consider the constitutionality of laws, engage in the legislative process? So your call and your comment is precisely the point that Justice Ginsburg and the dissenters lean upon.
There hasn't been a whole lot of attention paid, Jamie, and please, if you know, let me know about this. How many states or places like Manhattan and other parts of the country that have been covered under this have had to get preclearance? Have there been a lot of charges of discrimination?
That's an excellent point. You're asking how often do people actually suffer the burden that
right.
is complained about?
Yeah.
I honestly cannot answer that question off the cuff, but I do know that the reason Shelby brought the claim is because they, in fact, had to seek the preclearance coverage under Section 4B. And several of the southern jurisdictions, one in Mississippi, Shelby, had claimed that they were spending millions of dollars each time they wanted to make a change to their legislative change to their voting process, that it does cost a considerable amount of money each time you seek this preclearance. I know there was a jurisdiction in Texas that complained of spending millions of dollars, at least one in Mississippi, and of course this jurisdiction in Shelby that brought this action. Outside of the South, I have not heard of a complaint.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean there hasn't been one.
Right.
I simply have not heard of one.
Brian in Lake Villa, Illinois, the states should all be treated equally. There is as much overt racism in Illinois and Wisconsin as anywhere else. Look at the attempts to control voters in any state. Don't single out the South.
Yes, very good point. And the NAACP today, in response to that very point made after the decision came down by some in support of the decision, said that it has for years been asking Congress to expand the provisions to bring in other jurisdictions, that the South should not be singled out, that there are other places. Ohio is one that was named specifically. So that is a good point, that these aren't the only jurisdictions in which voting discrimination happens. But just because they aren't the only ones doesn't mean that there should not be federal oversight of these jurisdictions and perhaps more. And there's one other thing I should mention in response to your previous question. There was an opt-out provision. You could bail out was the actual phrase. If a jurisdiction felt that it did not warrant coverage, it could approach the federal government and seek a bailout. by showing proof that there was no discrimination in voting in that jurisdiction.
I see.
And similar to the bailout, there is something called a bail-in, a trigger process. If a jurisdiction was found to be discriminatory, it could be added to the list of those jurisdictions that were covered by the Voting Rights Act. So all of these various things that your callers and those writing in are raising were covered by the Act. Going back to the previous caller's point, that perhaps the court is engaging in some legislation that it really doesn't need to be doing. Perhaps the Act itself is already considering the various things the majority have raised in its opinion.
Mm-hmm. Darren is next. Hi, Darren.
Hi, Kathleen. Just kind of a question, or a comment, I should say. I happen to be reading a book right now, Billionaires and Bailout Bandits by Greg Plass. And there's concern about, let's say, voter fraud or things like that, where I think it's kind of smoke and mirrors. I think people have to be concerned about even having their vote count. In the beginning of his book, he shows that in the 2008 election, almost 3 million votes weren't cast, be it they were spoiled, there were absentee ballots that were mailed but not counted, or provisional ballots that were cast and not counted. That's just, we have to look at the bigger picture. They look at fraud, and you find a handful of a problem there. But we have 3 million votes that aren't being counted. That's a bigger problem. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call.
That's an excellent, excellent point and desperately important. I mean, in a country where our entire democracy is based on your right to vote and the value of your vote, we think back on the election of 2000, where we were all staring up the tiny little holes, little chads.
Right.
Remember that, Kathleen?
Oh, yes, I do.
I mean, you would think in the 21st century we would have a system down whereby every vote is counted. And we, of course, have problems with discrimination, but I think the voting system itself is behind the times. So we certainly we have a lot to do in this country with regard to voting, and I think we need to value it far more than we do as a society.
And that whole issue is just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger with photo IDs and redistricting and curtailing early voting. We got a whole new thing going on here now, right?
And now we have the whole issue of optical scanning and what that means for the validity of your vote, going back to the last caller's comment. And the John Lewis has recently been speaking a lot about immigrant rights and the rights of immigrants and voting. And the last March on Selma, which he does annually, folded in the issue of immigrant rights. So it's incredibly poignant, incredibly topical. And 1965 was a long time ago, but it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
And I want to leave you also, I know you're running out of time, but I do want to finish, if I could, with something that Justice Ginsburg wrote in her opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a quote of Dr. King. She said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice," as Dr. King so well quoted. She's quoting Dr. King. "But it only bends toward justice if there is a commitment to see that the task is completed." And then Justice Ginsburg finished by saying that commitment has been disturbed by today's opinion.
Hmm.
And I think that was very poignant for her to quote Dr. King and so very strongly condemn the opinion of the majority.
Yeah. And getting back to John Lewis, I was interested in some of his comments last night that he almost demanded a response from Eric Cantor because he said that Eric Cantor had marched with him in Selma and that he was very, very moved by the whole experience, and perhaps it got him so to heart that he will take this issue up in Congress. I don't know, but Lewis was fairly persuasive on that.
Well, I don't think there's been a response from Representative Cantor yet, but we can hope and pray that there will be.
Yeah. All right, Jamie, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your time and attention to this issue, and I look forward to tomorrow's coverage of DOMA and Prop 8, and those were more hopeful decisions today from the court, and a lot to talk about there.
Yes, very much. Busy day for the court the whole week. Thanks, Jamie. Jamie Floyd is a legal and political analyst she's worked for a lot of places, Court TV, ABC News, CBS News. She frequently guest hosts on WNYC Radio in New York. And tomorrow, there were major decisions on Defense of Marriage Act and Proposition 8 today. I know that you've heard about them during the news here, and we've been giving you updates that came down during the first hour of our program. We will tomorrow be talking about those decisions. We'll have two guests with us, Marcia Coyle, Chief Washington Correspondent for the National Law Journal, will join us, and Adam Winkler, Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law. So, that's coming up tomorrow.